This is still tape one, but we're now on side two, and we're ready to continue. Go ahead.
Rabbi, I really would like to go back quite a bit and ask you to reminisce a bit. Really, I have in mind the vignettes of life in your community, the shul you're in, who was here, and anything else that you that might come to mind as you think about it.
You mean here in Pittsburgh?
Yes, here in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. What you mentioned that the community, in fact, grew while you were here, mm-hmm. waxed, and then waned. So you really have covered the era. What happened? You said people came up from the hill, mm-hmm. and who were they? What happened to them? In other words, I'm asking for some vignettes, and in any density you want, both in educationally and in, socially and politically. What happened here? What happened in your era in this community?
Well, some of the old-timers, there was a Dr. Shoup, his son became a rabbi. He was, incidentally, he became a conservative rabbi, but he was also at Yeshiva University when I was there, and then he went to the other, his name was Dr. Shoup.
What year was that?
About whom? When I came here was 48.
Yeah,
he was the Dr. Shoup, he was an optometrist, he was the one who brought me here.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the leading lights later on, as the community progressed, were the Harrop family. Max Harrop was president for a number of years. Also, the Kaplan family. William Kaplan was president for a number of years of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
The Kaplans, the entire family, mm-hmm. they were in produce in the strip district, mm-hmm. Wholesale produce.
Mm-hmm.
These were the old-timers. Mm-hmm. They didn't have too much formal education. But oddly enough, they had a lot more common sense than some of the later people who did have
formal education.
Yeah. So this was the type of community that there was here. When I first came here, there was still a large Yiddish-speaking community. For example, when I first came here, I would be delivering sermons. One time it would be an English sermon, and the next time, I'm talking about Sabbath services, and the next time it would be a Yiddish sermon. During the high holidays, it was always English sermons, but during, let us say, other festivals, for example, like Passover and the others, for Yiska, the memorial service, it was in English, but some of the other sermons would be in Yiddish because they felt more at home there. I used to have a class in Talmud. I still have a class in Talmud, but one of the things that I had was a class in Talmud, and I had people sitting in the class that were shamosim, sextons in congregations, the ritual slaughterers, the shoftim, and so forth. People who were pretty well versed in Talmud and knew what the score was and knew what I was talking about. We used to have it Saturday afternoons. We'd have the class in Talmud usually for about an hour and a half. During the week, between the afternoon service and the evening service, between Mincha and Arif, we would usually have a class in Mishnayos, which is the Mishnah, and that would be between Mincha and Maariv. It usually lasted for about 15-20 minutes. It was a daily class. And also we would have classes in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which is the law book on Jewish law for laymen. That's not mm-hmm. the large Shulchan Aruch. And also we would have classes in Ein Yankov, that is the lighter portions of the Talmud that we would have classes in. So these were and all of these classes, the translation was in Yiddish. Now we still have the Talmud class, and we still have the classes in Mishnah and in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, no longer in Ein Yankov. They're not as long as they used to be. Mishnah is still as long as it used to be, but not the Talmud. But now we translate it in English. And the Talmud and Mishnah lend themselves more easily to translation in Yiddish, so it's a little bit more
difficult. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a little bit more difficult. I don't know, because the Yiddish was derived from the rhythm of the Talmud. So the rhythm of Yiddish is the rhythm of the Talmud, so it's easier to translate into Yiddish. Besides that, a lot of the words that you have to go in English and spend maybe 2 or 3 minutes to translate the word, in Yiddish you just say the word and they know what it is. It's a Talmudic word, but it's common Yiddish.
10% of Yiddish is...
So it's common...
I never thought of that.
So, for example, in English you have to translate what Ma'ika Mashmalon means. In Hebrew you don't have to translate... I mean, in Yiddish you don't have to translate it because it's come into the Yiddish language. This is basically... Now, when the people moved up into Stanton Heights, it was largely a young community. It was their first homes, and they had their children there, and that's why the schools became larger. In fact, when I came here, we didn't have a school, and one of the first...
This was around 1950.
Yeah, it was about 1950, yes. Mm-hmm. When I first came here, we didn't have a school, and we had a Sunday school, but we didn't have a Hebrew school, and I instituted the Hebrew school. We got a teacher in from New York, from my yeshiva, incidentally. And later on, we needed more than one teacher, but initially we had one teacher. So it became a young community, and we catered to their needs, you know. Then gradually it diminished, as I said, when the neighborhood began changing. And then after the neighborhood began changing, we have essentially an older community.
When was there a tipping point on that change?
Yes, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know how you would say it. You remember when there was, or maybe you don't remember, you may not be here long enough, but there was David Lawrence, who was a dear friend of mine. He was the mayor and then the governor, but then he was the governor. He was the mayor. He put in the Renaissance, and they took the Hill District and they renewed it. Well, the people who were in the Hill District had no place to go, so they went up into the Rushton area. And the Brushton area is contiguous to our area. And gradually they kept moving into our area, and our people began moving out.
Is that when there were... When was it when there were 500 children in the Hebrew school?
Yes. There were 500 members in the congregation.
Oh.
That means families, 500 families in the congregation. Mm-hmm. The Homewood Brushton area was, originally when we were there, was a more or less exclusive neighborhood. And as the people moved in, it shouldn't have happened. In fact, I was part of a movement at that time with the Christian clergy to try what we called stop the trend, to stop the whites from moving out of the neighborhoods. But in Homewood Brushton, we weren't successful at all.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, I would say that about 65 or so, they began having people overflowing from the Homewood Brushton area into the East Liberty area. And people from our more affluent congregation began moving out. Our people didn't move out, but as I said, they didn't replenish
themselves. No replenishments, yeah. That's really the kind of thing I we really need to know.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that it happened, because if they had let nature take its course and we would have been an integrated community, we could have lived in harmony side by side.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I was very much involved in some of that, where I came from, and then also in Pittsburgh. But this was a national phenomena, which was by no means unique in Pittsburgh.
Oh, do I realize that?
And,
In Pittsburgh it came rather late, because this was in the middle 60s, mm-hmm. because we had already had the first exodus when the Jewish community moved out of the Hill District, yeah. and that was the first exodus. This was the suburban area at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where did these people move to from here?
Well, they moved, some of them moved to Squirrel Hill, but not that many. Some of the older people moved to Squirrel Hill. But the younger children, the children who grew up here didn't move to Squirrel Hill. They moved out to the South Hills, they moved out to the North Hills, they moved out to the Fox Chapel area, mm-hmm. the various suburbia.
Yeah.
Mm. What happened was that when they moved out to these areas, they were no longer a homogeneous community. Would find one Jewish family or two Jewish family in a locale, and that was right. it. You never had them all congregated in one area yeah. anymore.
That didn't even happen in Monroeville, and a lot of Jews moved yes, into Monroeville.
Right. Well, that was one. That's true. One of the places I forgot to mention that, because now they're not moving to Monroeville, but one of the places that they used to move to, right. now they're moving more to Churchill and places like that.
Right.
But one of the places that originally they moved to was Monroeville area.
Mm. Mm.
Is there any sign of revived interest, Jewish interest, or moving or into the general area that is what we characterize as this community?
I haven't seen it.
I have not seen it.
I haven't seen yeah. it happening. Mm-hmm. With one exception. Since that time, you have had several apartment buildings growing up in the South Negley Center Avenue mm-hmm. area, Essex House and mm-hmm. so forth. But the Essex House is the most prominent of them, but it's actually a complex of about three apartment buildings. And you've been and the Jews in East Liberty have been moving into not all of them, but a goodly portion of them now that are selling their houses are moving into the Essex House.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Essex House, you also have people coming from Squirrel Hill mm-hmm. moving into the Essex House.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have that area where you have had a large influx of Jewish families.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that these families are largely two people families. It's a husband and wife, usually up in years, mm-hmm. retired. And so our people who move into these houses, Essex House or the others, continue their affiliation with our synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
But the people from Squirrel Hill who move into these mm-hmm. places continue their affiliation with their mm-hmm. synagogues in Squirrel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's sort of natural, I guess. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about your religious school. You already mentioned that you had, at one point, this large populations. How many teachers did you get? Where did you get them from? Were they any good? What happened to them? What happened
yeah,
to
well,
the,
we,
the
we,
decline of the school?
Yeah. We had one, the first teacher was a rabbi. He was mm-hmm. ordained from Yeshiva University. And he was with us for a while.
What was his name?
Rosenblatt.
Mm-hmm.
And he was with us for a while. Then we had a teacher by the name of Kazin, who had been like a cheder teacher,
mm-hmm.
but he was with us. And we also had with Kazin a progression of Israelis who were teaching here. I don't remember their
mm-hmm.
names.
Okay.
But then after that we had another teacher who was from the old school, a very learned man, his name was Beshkin. He also had a store in the neighborhood for selling religious items and books. Mm-hmm. But he was primarily he was with us. His name was Beshkin, and then he was a rabbi. He had been a rabbi in Farrell, Pennsylvania, north of Pittsburgh, and we brought him here. He was an excellent teacher, and we, besides him, we also had Roberts, Yehuda Roberts. He was also an ordained rabbi. He was from the Lubavitch, not Lubavitch, he was from the Torah Vada, well, what were, one of the major yeshivas in New York, but he was originally from Yehuda Roberts. He was a native of Pittsburgh, but he had gone to one of the major yeshivas in New York. And he decided not to practice the rabbinate, but he was into teaching. When we got him, he was knowledgeable, but we were able to develop him as the next here under guidance as an excellent pedagogue. And when he finally, finally left us, but he was because the school was diminishing. Mm-hmm. But he was one of the best teachers in Pittsburgh, and Beshkin was very good. We had a junior congregation at the time where they would convene on Saturdays for their Sabbath services. Mm-hmm. And most of them could lead in the service, and when they were bar mitzvah, they would conduct. Many of them would conduct the entire service. So we had a pretty good school in that sense. At one time, also when we had the 55 children, we also used Beshkin's son, who later became an attorney in the Boston area. But he was one of the first great teachers together with Roberts, and then when he moved out, we still retained the two, and then Beshkin passed away. Unfortunately, he was an older man, and then we had Roberts and a rabbi who was by the name of Korn. Moses Korn was his name, and when he retired, he settled in Israel. He's living in Jerusalem now. When the school was diminishing and Roberts we couldn't have more than one teacher, and Roberts had seniority, so he would have been the logical one to remain, but Korn only had this source of livelihood, whereas Roberts was in insurance, so Roberts of his own will said that Korn remain. It finally was with Korn. And then when the school became small, that we only had 4 to 6 children in a class, well, I felt it was no longer a viable school, and we made an agreement with the Hebrew Institute where we would send our children there. It was part of their dues. The tuition was always part of the dues, and we made an arrangement with Hebrew Institute where that setup was continued. We paid Hebrew Institute a certain amount monthly for that service.
What was the peak number of teachers you had?
The peak number of teachers was 3. Mm-hmm. In other words, actually for most of the life of the school we had 2, and then when the school became large we had. I'm talking about Hebrew school. Sunday school. we had through all the grades, so we had about 10 teachers.
Tell me.
Yeah.
Did any of this activity take place in this area?
Yes.
Here in this building.
In this building, we.
So when you talk about the school,
the school was right here. In fact, the entrance that you came in, if you notice, it says Talmud Torah, and that was the Talmud Torah entrance. That was the school entrance. In fact, the door of the door is made so that it cannot be locked inside. So that you know, it has one of those sort of. Bars that you push down, because with children you've got to be able, in case God forbid a fire, you've got to be able to push out.
So when
we had four classrooms. Oh, then we had we were having three teachers, but we had four classrooms there.
When was this building?
You're talking about Hermann Feinberg.
Yeah.
This base of Medrash, his name, he dedicated in memory of his in-laws, the Rudens.
Yeah. Had a high regard for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when was this built? This was
built in 1922.
Do we have the name of this down?
It's called Adath Jeshurun Congregation.
Adath Jeshurun.
Jeshurun. And then?
Give to me a
Adath Jeshurun.
Yeah, how do you spell it?
Ayin Dalet Sof. Yeshurun. Yud Shin.
Yud Shin.
Reish. Vav Nun. Sometimes they eliminate the original of Vav. Yud Shin Vav.
Okay.
Yeah, Yud Shin Vav Reish. But sometimes instead of using a Vav after the Shin, they put a Shurik underneath
it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In fact, in our stationery, it is without the shin.
Without the
vav after the shin, yeah.
But in English, is it a Y? Yeshurun?
Jeshurun.
J-E-S.
Just like Jerusalem instead of the Y. Jerusalem, so it's Jeshurun. It means the congregation of the upright. But actually, Yeshurun is the poetic name for Israel. Like Columbia, the gem of the ocean, Columbia is the poetic name for America. So Yeshurun is the poetic name for Israel. Mm-hmm. And Adath Jeshurun was
the congregation of the upright.
Of the upright. Mm-hmm. That's a quotation from Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 70s, 1978, one of the congregations that was here in the East End area decided to merge with us, and that's the Knesset Israel congregation. Mm. Incidentally, when I came here, there were three congregations in the area. Mm. There was our congregation, there was the Bnei Israel, which was conservative, mm-hmm. Incidentally, there's a difference of opinion who came first, Bnei Israel or we. The old-timers told me that actually it was originally our congregation was the first, mm-hmm. and when they had there was a Davis family here, mm-hmm. and they had a sort of an altercation within the family, and mm-hmm. the majority of the family... that's according to our people.
Yeah.
Bnei Israel people will disagree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The majority of the Davis family broke off and they formed the Bnei Israel congregation, and only one of the Davis remained with us, and he's one of the men on the cornerstone of the congregation.
So you had Knesset Israel, Bnei Israel, and the Adath Jeshurun.
No, the three congregations that were here were Toras Chaim.
Uh-huh.
That was a smaller... We had 500 and they had about 200 members.
Where was it?
It's still in existence.
Oh,
it's on Negley Avenue.
Yes. Yeah,
and
Negley.
Then and then after that and Bnei Israel. These were the three congregations. Mm-hmm. Then after that from the Hill District, they had congregations in the Hill District. Now, these three congregations were congregations that were born in the East End area. But then in the Hill District, they had congregation Knesset Israel and Machzik HaAdas. And when they stopped being there, they needed another congregation. I don't know whether they felt they needed another congregation. And they moved up here. So they had Machzik HaAdas on Negley Avenue and Knesset Israel on Negley Avenue. Mm-hmm. And then there was a Rabbi Silverberg, a Polish rabbi, who came into town. And he had been in the Polish synagogue had brought him here. And he had And he had been down in the Hill District with the it was called, I believe, Morgan David, in the Hill District, and then he needed a congregation, so he built a congregation in Highview Street here in Pittsburgh. It was called Morgan David. It since has burned down. It was never rebuilt.
Highview
Street. And there was a humorous incident with it. They had some sort of dedication there or something, and on a Sunday, and I couldn't make it. And I called in a telegram congratulating them. And when I gave the address, I said, Congregation Morgan David. And I noticed that the operator was taking the telegram, sort of was hesitant. And then afterwards, when I finished, she said, Rabbi, do you mind if I ask you a question? I said, go ahead. And she said, how come they named the synagogue after a bottle of wine? So good. I explained question. To her what a Morgan David was.
Smart woman.
Whatever happened to Bess Yankiv, what used to be on the Hill District?
Well, Bess Yankiv were two of the major, although my wife's grandfather had several congregations, but his two major congregations were Beis HaMedrash HaGadol and Bess Yankiv. Mm-hmm. And they were both together. In fact, their cemeteries were contiguous in the McKees Rocks area. Mm-hmm. Their cemeteries were contiguous. And because he was their rabbi over all the years, they were practically considered two sister congregations. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened is when they had the urban renewal, which I referred to with David Lawrence, they decided to tear down the area where most of the synagogues were. Mm-hmm. And there was a movement to try at least to Bais Yankiv, if they couldn't retain. But there was a movement to try to retain Beis HaMedrash HaGadol. Mm-hmm. In fact, the last function that was held at Beis HaMedrash HaGadol was when Rabbi Ashinsky passed away. And the whole area was packed. The synagogue was packed, and the city blocked off the area for eight blocks around, and it was all packed in there. And the last thing and all of the city officials were there, the mayor and everybody mm-hmm. else. I officiated, but other rabbis did as well. Mm-hmm. This was the last function that they had. About a year or so afterwards, they tore it down.
What year was that?
Oh, it was about my son was born in 55, and he was named after Rabbi Ashinsky. He was about 54. Mm-hmm. I think it was 54.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. But in any event, it was about that time. And they tried to make the urban renewal go up to Beis HaMedrash HaGadol. Mm-hmm. They weren't successful. The church that was right next to Beis HaMedrash
was that on Washington Avenue?
Yeah, well, it was called the Washington Avenue
Synagogue. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
It was the
place.
Largest synagogue in
yeah.
Pittsburgh. And in fact, when the Jews were in the Hills District, this was the synagogue in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
They couldn't, the church that was next to it was retained, but that was the end. But they got money from the city for the because they yeah. the city absorbed it, mm-hmm. so they got money and they got enough money to be able to rebuild, and they rebuilt in practically the same area where it was, but it was the new building. It's a beautiful building, but it's a
I've
small
been there
building.
Several times.
It's a small building, and it is the base Medrash HaGadol and Beis Yankiv. It's both of them together.
Oh, I never knew that. It's close to Fifth Avenue. Isn't
yes,
it?
It's close
Just
to Fifth Avenue. Yeah. If for a long time it served as the synagogue for the merchants on Fifth
right.
Avenue
yeah.
before the merchants moved out of there. And for a long time, it served as the synagogue for them. They would go there, let us say, if they had the yard site, the anniversary right. of the death of the dear one, and they were still...
get a minyan.
They still do, yeah.
You know,
but at one time, they used to be packed for Mincha Maariv,
yeah.
and also for the morning service, mm-hmm. because they would go there before they would go to their
go to
place
work.
Of business.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, I've been there once or twice
yeah.
recently, and I believe
yeah.
that they function.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was in my childhood.
Beck Kaplan was...
Beck Kaplan was the one. Because his father, during the time that Rabbi Ashinsky was there, Rabbi Ashinsky hired him as a Gemara Malama, the teacher of Gemara. And then, of course, when Rabbi Ashinsky passed away, he was still around, so he was considered the rabbi. But by then, it was no longer much of a functioning institution, except for the people in the Hill
district.
And so he was considered the rabbi of the congregation then, because he was the last rabbi. But originally, it was Rabbi Ashinsky who was the rabbi of the congregation, and then when he passed, when he had already passed away, but Beck Kaplan out of, he was, if you knew Beck, he was one of the princes of the world.
Prince of
the world,
yes.
Yeah, and he kept up the congregation, and he was the one who was the guiding light behind the rebuilding of the new the new congregation.
Yeah, Rose is still around.
Yeah, Rose, yeah, sure. The Beck and Rose were amongst my dearest friends. Mm-hmm. So this was there. Incidentally, this is an odd thing that not too many people realize. In the 20s and in the Rabbi Ashinsky was considered the main rabbi in Pittsburgh. When they built this congregation, they called Rabbi Ashinsky in to be the rabbi of the congregation. In fact, some of the old-timers, when I was hired to be rabbi of the congregation, said, "It's wonderful. Rabbi Ashinsky was our first rabbi, and you, his grandson, are our rabbi now." So he was the one who was the overseer of the construction of the congregation. Mm-hmm. He was the one who made all the steps that we have to walk to go up to the main sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
We seat 1,100 in the main sanctuary, together with the balcony. And I have a book, I don't know whether you people have it, but there's a book that came out in 1920.